The new chairs?
Well, members, we don't quite have a quorum yet, but why don't we get started here? Start the meeting out with, we got a, started out with the governor's office. We have a overview and their change level items. So you want to come forward and start? And I may interrupt you when we get a quorum, so we get to take the minutes and that, but just...
He's not the governor.
Well, as representatives of the governor's office.
Very true. Well, good morning.
Welcome to the
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present information about the governor's office. I'll provide a brief background, some information about the office, and then I'm happy, of course, to answer any questions that any of the committee members might have. So my name is Chris Schmitter. I'm the Chief of Staff to Governor Tim Walz and Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. With me today is Amanda Simpson. Amanda is the office's Chief Operating Officer. She's to my right, and she is the real brains behind the operation in the governor's office. She's been in that office for more than 14 years, previously as residence manager. So she served for both Governor Dayton and Governor Pawlenty. Also with us off to the side is Magdalia Loyola, who's Deputy Chief of Staff for Public Engagement. She joined the office in February. She has a distinguished career in the field of public engagement, over 20 years of experience in that field, connecting organizations and the communities they serve. So the office of the governor and lieutenant governor serves all Minnesotans, and our entire team is focused on advancing the governor and lieutenant governor's commitment to building one Minnesota. The governor believes deeply in the model of servant leadership. I've known him 15 years, and it's kind of core to his being and his experience as a teacher and a veteran. His values of inclusiveness, engagement, teamwork, integrity, evidence-based decision-making, problem-solving, results, and equity create the lens through which this entire office does its work. This office serves over 5.5 million Minnesota residents. The work of the governor and lieutenant governor includes managing the day-to-day operations of state government, providing oversight for 24 cabinet-level departments and 59 non-cabinet-level executive agencies, filling judicial vacancies, and appointing more than 1,300 Minnesotans for roughly 140 boards and commissions. The governor serves as chair of the State Executive Council, the State Board of Investment, the Land Exchange Board, and the Board of Pardons. He is commander-in-chief of the Minnesota National Guard and oversees emergency response for the state, which, as many of you know, has been incredibly important in this rough winter that we've had all across the state. And as you, of course, know, he develops biennial budgets and policy recommendations for consideration in the legislature. The lieutenant governor's chief duty is to assist the governor in carrying out the functions of the executive branch, and she is prepared to act in the governor's place in the event of the governor's absence. The lieutenant governor's duties also include chairing the Capital Area Architectural Planning Board, serving as a member of the State Executive Council, and chairing the Advisory Committee on Capital Area Security. The structure and operation of our office is designed to best serve the governor's leadership style and decision-making process. There are a lot of similarities between the structure that this office uses and past governors like Governor Dayton and Governor Pawlenty, but some differences. In the office, reporting to me, but with direct access to the governor and lieutenant governor, is a team of senior managers responsible for the core functions of the office, including policy development, legal counsel, legislative relations, communications, constituent response and public engagement, appointments, scheduling, intergovernmental relations, emergency management and homeland security, and administrative support. Every day, the governor and lieutenant governor are guided by their commitment to improving the lives of as many Minnesotans as they can. We have built a team that works together and with department and agency heads across the executive branch, always work with a goal of making state government more accessible and responsive to the people of Minnesota. We respond daily to constituent and citizen requests for help and support. Of the operating budget of this office, staff costs are the largest portion because it's critical that we have a team of high-performing, high-caliber subject matter experts. Additionally, the nature of our work demands flexible people who are skilled at responding quickly to a crisis while still maintaining a consistent level of service to constituents that is both supportive and timely. The members of our policy team, again, that's one of the functions in the office, serve as liaisons with state executive branch agencies act as ambassadors to stakeholders on policy and legislative issues, oversee the development of the governor's legislative agenda, as well as monitor and brief the governor on bills and proposals moving at the legislature. Another function, of course, is the communications team. That team is the point of contact for the media, and they support the governor and lieutenant governor in communicating their priorities and positions to the people of the state. Our office deals with varied, complex, and numerous legal issues as well. So we have a general counsel and a legal function in the office. Some of those issues relate to formal responsibilities of the office, such as making appointments to the state judicial branch, deciding whether to grant pardons, and preparing the state to deal with emergency and crisis situations. The office processes extraditions, executive orders, fee to trust applications, emergency management assistance compact agreements, and state disaster assistance requests. It's an office that I can say from experience in the past couple of months can go to action late at night on a weekend, if need be, to sign an executive order to provide emergency assistance throughout the state. Other legal issues are less predictable, and therefore it's essential that our legal team can effectively address many diverse legal questions that arise. Our office has two locations in the Capitol and an office at the governor's residence. We have 41 staff members and then an additional 5 employees assigned by other agencies, a groundskeeper at the residence, 2 IT professionals, and 2 staff members from the children's cabinet. Our office is roughly 66% female and 24% people of color, and represents people from diverse backgrounds and from across the state. From 2011 to 2018, Governor Dayton, with his appointments function, filled 180 judicial vacancies and 3,000 Minnesotans to 130 boards and commissions, increasing diversity by 98.5%. Similarly, the governor has that appointments task in front of him, Governor Walz. And so for all appointments, we have a team that tracks expiring terms and vacancies, identifies and recruits candidates for vacant positions, verifies credentials, and coordinates the background check process on applicants. And Governor Walz has recently appointed the Judicial Selection Commission, furthering the commitment to judicial equity in our state. In April 2016, Governor Dayton also created a Chief Inclusion Officer position in the governor's office. In this role, James Burroughs oversaw the state of Minnesota's efforts to ensure that the state's workforce reflects the rich diversity of our state. By increasing economic opportunity for people of color, people with disabilities, veterans, and others who are underrepresented in our workforce, we are beginning to interview candidates for the Chief Inclusion Officer position in this administration next week in conjunction with a panel and with the MMB department. Governor Walz has expanded on the work of Governor Dayton, both in the area of inclusion and equity and public engagement and outreach, with a new Office of Public Engagement and Public Engagement team with senior leaders who are working to engage Minnesotans across the state, increasing the state's civic engagement and partnerships with communities of color, communities in greater Minnesota, and other diverse communities. This work will complement the work of the Chief Inclusion Officer, helping to expand the state's commitment to be the best employer in Minnesota. Primarily, this office will ensure that we respond to our constituents and ensure that Minnesotans affected by decisions have a seat at the table. The Office of Public Engagement also works to ensure that the governor's office continues to be accessible to Minnesotans by providing individualized assistance for constituent questions, comments, requests, and concerns. This office also oversees management of the front desk, special projects such as proclamations and certificates, responding to messages from constituents, and advancing events for the governor and lieutenant governor. The office receives a significant volume of mail, email, telephone calls, and constituent visits, something that each of you is obviously very familiar with. The office receives over 125,000 constituent contacts per year, looking back at Governor Dayton's term. In general, the contacts fall into 3 major categories: urging the governor to take a specific position on an issue area, or seeking the governor's position on an issue area, requesting the governor's participation in an event, or requesting the governor's assistance in obtaining benefits or services from the state government. Last year, we created this office under Governor Dayton, over 400 proclamations, 500 recognition letters, and over 2,500 certificates honoring Eagle Scouts, retirements, and length of service in state government. As the governor and lieutenant governor travel across the state, and as they have in recent months, Minnesotans talk often about how they feel disconnected from their government. That is why we have asked, as you all know, for an increase to the governor's office appropriation to fund our expanded constituent outreach and community engagement work with this Office of Public Engagement. This funding would allow us to expand the scope of the office. It would allow the office to be not just reactive in its services, but proactive. It would allow the office to create and coordinate more opportunities for direct dialogue between the administration and the people of Minnesota. This includes holding events in local communities rather than expecting Minnesotans to travel to the Capitol. It would ensure that our state's diverse communities have a receptive team dedicated to making their voices heard within state government and helping their concerns be translated into action by appropriate state agencies. Now, as you may have seen in the past couple of days, with the change in the state's budget forecast, Governor Walz has made clear publicly that we are working on paring down that budget request. And so Governor Walz believes that when dealing with a budget, it's important to look in the mirror first. And so he wants to lead by example, and before asking agencies to reduce their budget request increases, change items, et cetera, the governor plans to reduce this request for an increase, and we're looking at exactly what that means, whether it's a reduction or pulling it back completely. We're looking at our budget right now to see what adjustments we can make. All that being said, this public engagement work is critically important, and so it's critical to the governor and lieutenant governor that the team that does this work continues to do that work in an aggressive and proactive way, within the budget that we have. So we'll still find ways, any ways possible, for this office to do that important work. Now, ultimately, it's the honor of everybody on this staff to serve the governor and lieutenant governor and to be an active participant in creating not just a better Minnesota, but a unified one Minnesota. The staff, I can just say personally, are some of the best, smartest, hardest working people I've ever met. They serve the people of the state with distinction, and every employee in the office of the governor strives to match their dedication and commitment, the commitment of Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here this morning and happy to answer any questions that you have, and if they're especially difficult, happy to have Amanda answer them instead. Thank you again.
Thank you, sir. Representative Quam, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the admin section, pages 4 and 8, the 3,800 permanent school is zeroed out. Is there a difference in the treatment of that? Is it being transferred over to? I'm just curious because it's, you don't see a lot of zeroed out.
Mr. Chair, members of
the that's the Department of Admin.
The governor's budget is the thing that's zeroed out. When you zero out something on the governor's budget, there's either a change or they got rid of it. I'm interested in how they're changing it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, if you're referring to the Department of Administration's change item, the funding for the school trust lands director is being transferred from the Department of Administration to the Department of Natural Resources. So you see a zero on admin's pages and then the increased spending in DNR.
Mr. Chair, I thought it was something like that, but in general, if something like, that's not trivial, it's from the governor's, it's being moved over, it'd be nice to have a summary of all of those types of activities, because that, seems like a major, governmental policy change. Thank you.
And Representative Quam, that would probably be more appropriate when admin is here to ask them how that, because we're here presenting the budget for the governor's office itself, not the governor's entire budget.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Our insert book is the governor's budget. The question is on the governor's budget, and since it's listed in his proposed budget, it's part of the budget. I would assume that we aren't saying, we can't have them answer anything about the budget, then why are they proposing it to us if we can't ask about it?
Representative Quam, each one of these tabs, and granted, we have probably more tabs, more different groups than other people, other budget divisions, but they're here presenting for the governor's office, mm-hmm. not the governor's entire budget. And that's a distinction that I understand. They may have the answers, and we're going to have to include this as a whole. But the admin will be here presenting their budget and their budget items and their change items. that's part of their division, and that's their part that they're bringing forward.
Mr. Chair, if I can clarify the distinction. The distinction is you've got all of these sub-things underneath the governor. The person, I assume, that decides that it's something's going to be moved from one to the other is the governor. So that decision being made by the governor, the governor's representatives would be the appropriate people to address the reasoning behind. Now, this specific one, I had the assumption of what was happening, but we should not have the assumption because not everybody's been involved before. So the members of the committee should have a summary of all the major changes made by the governor when he's shifting something between one department to another department and those type of activities, because that's a executive decision-making process. And since the head of the executive branch is what makes that decision, the appropriate people are the, why was this, and can we get a summary of this type of activity, should come from the executive representatives and not the specific, subgroup of admin, amateur sports, etc., because they're just following the directive of the executive. That's the distinction I'm having, and that's why I brought it up here as an avenue to try and get a, how should we put it, summary from the admin. So that's why I asked the question. That's why I think it's valid to actually get a summary of where they've moved things between, because that's not trivial. And oftentimes the legislature does get involved in how things are organized.
Sometimes Representative Quam, sometimes we're the ones that make those decisions. Sometimes the governor new governor rearranges how where different departments do that. But yes, but right now that we're here, we're overseeing the governor's budget, his office for his budget, not the entire budget, is what we're not here. What is that, Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we can't ask why the executive has made a decision to move functions or spending between.
Representative Quam, they may or may not have that answer, but they're here to discuss what the budget, the governor's office itself, the running of that office, and what the change items are for that. As he explained, the one change item they had was the new Office of Public Engagement, which they're looking at cutting back. And I think there was a tweet last week about that.
So my request to the people here is they go back and see if someone can give us a summary of those changes, because I assume that they talked to the appropriate people that actually could generate that and provide it to the committee. It was not an intent that they would go through that entire thing here, but they are the conduit for us to communicate and request data.
Thank you, Representative Quam.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, Representative Quam, we're happy to take that feedback back and get that information if it would be helpful.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. one of the things that we heard this year over and over was "see me, hear me." I think every candidate who ran for office this year, no matter what side of the table you're sitting on, heard "see me, hear me" loud and clear. So when I hear you talking about the potential of cutting back in this chief inclusion office, I'm wondering if you couldn't say just a little bit more about the role of that, of a chief inclusion officer, please.
Mr. Schmitter.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, Representative, thank you for that question. I think I completely agree, and I think the governor and lieutenant governor would both say that over the course of the campaign and then in the transition effort, they heard from many Minnesotans about the importance of outreach and connecting and the chance for Minnesotans of all different stripes to weigh in on decisions that government is making. And so that's why an Office of Public Engagement is really important for them. It's something that Governor Dayton and Governor Plenty and other governors have done, but expanding on that is important. And then to your point about the Chief Inclusion Officer, That was a key addition that Governor Dayton made to his administration, and both Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor value that position and think it's very important to have an inclusion officer that provides the strategic guidance and structure within government on diversity and inclusion efforts to make sure that we're recruiting, for instance, the very best, and that there's, you know, enterprise-wide training that encourages and advances diversity and inclusion within government. But I completely agree, and I know the governor and lieutenant governor do, that sort of engagement and outreach work and inclusion work in both the chief inclusion officer position and engagement office are really, really important. And I think the governor and lieutenant governor demonstrated it well, for instance, on the transition. So between the election and Thanksgiving, the transition had, you know, more than 1,000 meetings with different stakeholders about commissioner appointments, and it was a whole range from groups coming from, you know, on one of the first days there were, you know, various groups that represent labor and the Chamber of Commerce right there in the room talking about their commissioner appointments, and we heard very positive feedback on that outreach and engagement work to give Minnesotans the chance to weigh in on the decisions they're making.
Representative Claiborne.
Yeah, I have one more. So when we think about having a more inclusive workplace and this public engagement, if you could just give me just some real concrete examples of how you feel that you could be expanding the work with public engagement. I mean, I see the things in the book, you know, the 400 proclamations, the 500 recognition letters. Those are all great, but I'm looking for real substantive public engagement. If you could maybe help me understand that a little bit better of how you would expand that.
Mr. Schmitter.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, yes, appreciate that question very much, and I think that there's a couple of different ways in which the office can expand that work. One is leveraging the engagement and outreach work that's already happening within state government. And so it's not unusual for legislative staff at agencies or communication staff at agencies to coordinate with their counterparts in the governor's office on the work that those functions do. It's important to the governor and lieutenant governor to do the very same thing around public engagement and outreach. So some agencies do an extensive amount of outreach work, as you all know. You know, DNR is one example. Some agencies are starting to increase their outreach work. And so one critical piece of this office in terms of expanding is sort of coordinating efforts across state government to make sure that agencies are responsive to the Minnesotans, whether individuals, companies, what have you, who are affected by the decisions those agencies are making. So part of it is that enterprise-wide coordination. And the second piece, I think, is our goal, we've said it in the change request, is to see a 25% increase in proactive, and to start measuring our proactive engagement throughout the community. And so, you know, there an example would be, well, we're about to make a decision on X, Y, and Z piece of legislation, ensuring that the stakeholder engagement has occurred to know, okay, well, what does the chamber think about this decision? What does X group think about this decision? What does individual groups of citizens who might be impacted think of that decision? And so I think there's the reactive piece, as you mentioned, and that continues to increase as our population grows. And then there's this proactive piece that we would like to increase to make sure that Minnesotans, as best they can, feel like they have the chance to weigh in. I think that one example of that is natural to the governor, given his experience in Congress, of where this works really well is in congressional offices. And Representative Long knows this well from having worked in a congressional office as well. House offices and Senate offices often have significant outreach staff who are assigned to different communities and are on the ground interacting with those communities to make sure that a senator or representative knows what's going on and has input before making decisions. They have different budgets, and so it's a different thing for them. But I think that's the lens through which the governor views this. When he was in Congress last year, for instance, his team did a southern Minnesota way of life tour where they toured every single county in his congressional district and talked to mayors and county commissioners and local leaders and ordinary citizens at coffee shops, and they developed legislation out of that would help provide grants to local to small towns in greater rural America. And they also provided a report, kind of an exit memo at the end of his time in Congress on this topic. And I think you'd hear from folks throughout southern Minnesota, where I grew up and which the governor represented for years in Congress, a lot of appreciation for that level of proactive outreach. So I appreciate your push in encouraging that the increased proactive work.
May I have one quick follow-up?
Representative Claiborne.
I would just like to extend an invitation to this great city of Plymouth. We are a suburban district. We're a moderate district, and I think it would be a great place to hear the heartbeat of America. Thank you.
Representative Long. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You alluded to my previous work, and I did have the pleasure of running an office that did significant public engagement for an elected official. Our office had seven people doing that public engagement, and we represented an eighth of the state. You're asking for seven people to do this work for the entire state. That seems to me to be a pretty reasonable request. The work that we did in representing an eighth of the state, we found that those seven people were fully tapped, fully utilized the entire year. And it wasn't just, I think, the expectation of constituents that they wanted to be able to have the opportunity to speak to their representative and let them know how they were feeling on particular topics. But it was also, to your point, the proactive development of good policy that we were actually able to come up with proposals because of the engagement we were doing that were responding to the needs of those individuals. You gave one example from the Way of Life tour. But I think that in the state government context as well, when you're doing this public engagement, you're going to be able to have better policy outcomes in the governor's office, too. And I'm just wondering if you have thoughts from the perspective of the governor's office on areas where you think this public engagement would actually improve the policy outcomes as well.
Mr. Schmitter.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, Representative Long, appreciate that question very much. And I think that the answer is there are any number of areas in which I think this type of office and this type of work would improve policymaking in the governor's office and throughout state government. First off, just make the point that I completely agree. I think then Congressman Walz had a similar number of staff in his congressional office on the outreach team when I worked for him in southern Minnesota, and so I think that. And I know that senators who do lead the state statewide have much larger outreach teams. You know, for the governor and lieutenant governor, it's important to do this work proactively, regardless of the size of the team. But I agree with you. There's a huge need, and there are Minnesotans knocking down the doors of this office. In fact, one of the recommendations from Governor Dayton's team outgoing was to increase the size of this team, given the demands of the work. But I think that it's a critical point to make that it's not it's not simply we've made a decision, now we're going to go out and communicate it. It is, in fact, we're considering an issue or a problem, we'd like your input, or we just want to know what problems or issues you're facing. And so I think in any number of areas, in education, healthcare, but then, it's sort of more concrete and, an issue like paid family leave, the equity grants that were part of the governor's budget through DEED, but I think just to keep going, you can get even more sort of detailed. The governor worked for years on the House Veterans Affairs Committee in Congress and worked extensively with county veteran service officers who oftentimes do incredible work, as many of you know, in their counties to connect veterans with the state Veterans Affairs Department and the federal department to make sure they're getting their benefits. And when I worked for him in Congress, I worked on these issues. CVSOs are the unsung heroes of counties working on veterans issues. So that's an issue where you can imagine, and the governor has done some of this even in his first few months on the job, going and connecting with CVSOs on the ground through this engagement office and saying, what do you need to do your job better in terms of state resources, state support from the governor's office, whether it's funding or structural support from the VA department. And the governor's already starting to think about, through the budget and other means, what his office can do to help CVSOs better do their work, which means better outcomes for our state's veterans, whether they're in Hennepin County or Olmsted County. And so I think that's exactly the sort of example that the governor thinks about in wanting to have an active office, because we can get to better outcomes on big issues, but on very specific and narrow issues as well through the sort of work. And if you're not out there talking to CVSOs, for example, you're not going to learn about the issues they care about at all.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that answer. I understand that as you're looking at the entire budget and with the new forecast, you have some tough decisions to make. In the opinion of one legislator, I urge you to keep this proposal intact. I think 2.5 FTEs is a pretty modest request given the scope of the work that the governor is doing and the importance of making sure that we're having policy that's informed from the public. So, thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Mr. Schmitter. Couple of points. I think we already have an office of public engagement, and that would be the governor's office, but he also already has 201 employees or people on staff. That's the House and Senate. So if you want to consider that, you know, we all are part of that public engagement office already, and I think the analogy rings true from his days in Congress, but now he's an executive, and we are the people in the House seats. We are the people in the Senate. And so if I could offer any advice to the governor now is, as the chief engagement officer, he should be engaging with the House and the Senate, his staff, who do have those relationships with the county officials, who do have the relationships with the managers of the elevators and the YMCAs and the barbershops and the lumberyards and the medical clinics. We already have those relationships, and I think as an engagement between the House leadership and the House representatives, we all are engaging in conversations with our constituents. I think it's a bit of a redo to consider that he has to do that when he already has a staff that is intimately aware of what's going on in the state of Minnesota, across the state of Minnesota, and we are House members and we are Senate members. So just to that point. I do have a question, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Schmitter. In the past, there has been a practice of agency chargebacks that are outside the scope or the purview of the governor's budget per se or his office. And the rationale behind it has been to justify work that has been done by the governor's office on behalf of other agencies and they're charging for those services. I'm wondering if that practice is going to be continued by this administration.
Mr. Schmitter.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, Representative Albright, appreciate both of your points. But first, I would just say Governor completely agrees, and Lieutenant Governor, both of them being former legislators themselves, that the work of the legislature in engaging with communities is second to none, and that you all know your communities incredibly well. And so we look forward to engaging in every way possible with every member of the legislature on what matters to their constituents. And one of the things I think many of you know, the governor, lieutenant governor have and the first lady have done in the past month is start to have receptions at the governor's residence for members of the legislature over the course of several weeks as a first opportunity to connect with members and get the chance to talk about their community. So we welcome any ideas and opportunities to do that with each of you. And as you have additional ideas, feedback, issues that matter to your constituents, please do pass them along in whatever way possible. We're eager to have that kind of relationship and work with you on meeting the needs of your constituents. As to the issue of agency agreements, or also I think it's been called the Special Revenue Fund, Amanda has some deeper familiarity with that issue than me, but at this point in our budget, we plan to hold that fund consistent with the level that it was at under Governor Dayton. We do not currently plan to increase the Special Revenue Fund beyond its current level.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, and I recognize that the First Lady is taking a much more active role, because we haven't had a First Lady for several years, so we recognize that. So in deference and with all due respect to her position, Will she have a staff, or what party does the governor's office have in terms of support of her initiatives, her outreach, her objectives as First Lady of the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Schmidt or Ms. Simpson, whoever.
Yeah, sure. Chair Nelson, members of the committee, the First Lady does have one staff member, Matt Loomis. That's consistent with past practice. First Lady Pawlenty had a staffer for, I think, her entire time in office, and so that's consistent with past practice. And I think at last count, I think it was roughly 40 or so governor's offices across the country, you know, 40 out of 50 or so First Ladies do have staff members, so it's common practice. You know, Matt's role is multifold, partially to support her in some of the outreach events that we've seen at the residence or work that she does connecting with a constituents of the governor, partially to sort of schedule and staff at events, partially to support her in the work that she does as a part of the governor's agenda. So it's sort of a multifold portfolio, similar to the staffer that First Lady Pawlenty had during the Pawlenty administration.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that the First Lady makes a pretty mean ginger snap cookie. I look forward to.
I had like five of them the last time she made them, so it's too good.
I look forward to sharing recipes with the First Lady. You know, I think it's not troublesome, but I just want to talk to you a little bit about the assertion that public engagement has not been occurring in the past. And we talked about this yesterday, and I appreciate meeting with you and your staff about this. So I'm wondering if, in the context of my conversations and the various departments and jurisdictions that also have responsibilities to transportation, to education, to public health, that type of thing, I'm just wondering how those departments, are you suggesting that the governor is responsible for all public discourse, or how is it that you find it necessary to invite even more discourse when you have commissioners, you have a Senate, and you have a House who all have staff, and yet there seems to be this a bit of a preoccupation with public engagement at the gubernatorial level when that is what he is delegating to his agency heads. So I'm just wondering what distinction or difference you could refine in terms of, has it been happening in the past, but now it's not, or it was it done incorrectly in the past? I'm just trying to get an understanding in terms of the why and wherefore. It is about a 10% increase. And as a similarity, I certainly hope that we're not thinking about increasing the cost of government by 10% across the board. I don't think the taxpayers are ready for that, in addition to other issues that your administration has put forth. But I'm looking for an understanding in terms of the why and wherefore that this seems to be such an important item in the governor's budget.
Mr. Schmitter.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, Representative Albright, I appreciate the question very much, and I want to be very clear here. Do not mean to assert that public engagement, outreach, work, constituent work hasn't been happening in the past under Governors Dayton or Pawlenty, or within individual agencies. It certainly has. And so I think that the governor and lieutenant governor's focus on this is not to undermine or malign the work that's been done in the past. I think, in fact, it's quite the opposite. It's an acknowledgement of how important that work is to the functioning of government and wanting to find ways not in an excessive way, as I think Representative Long pointed out, but small ways to expand on that work. In particular within the governor's office, but throughout state government. And I think, it's not been happening, but I think to Representative Clevhorn's point, I think the governor and lieutenant governor certainly have heard, they did a lengthy tour during the transition covering spots in all four corners of the state. And what they heard from Minnesotans was, we want more interaction and engagement with our government, which is not in any way to criticize anybody else who's been doing that work. It's just an acknowledgement that, as you all know better than me, your constituents, the people of the state, are continually yearning for more and more opportunity to engage with their government, which I think is a good thing. And so we're not looking to make dramatic or radical changes. We're not looking to malign or undermine all the work that's been done, but we are looking to opportunities to continue to expand on chances to connect with individuals and groups that represent citizens and Minnesotans to find ways to do good work. You know, and just to give an example, we were at the National Governors Association conference a week and a half ago, and the governor of Washington Washington State's a bit bigger than Minnesota. They've got a much larger governor's office staff. I think it's about double the size. And the example that they gave of where engagement work was especially helpful was during mudslide natural disasters in the last couple of years in the state of Washington. So in Washington, the governor's office has issue-based outreach staff, as I understand it, but then also geographically assigned outreach staff and engagement staff. The helpful thing for them in that context was when a mudslide happened, they would open, depending on where it was in the state, it's a large state, obviously, like ours, they'd open up an emergency operations center that was localized on the ground, and so you'd have engagement and outreach and emergency management staff from state agencies, from the local government, and then also from the governor's office. And you might say, okay, well, why is that necessary? Well, part of the reality is it was just helpful to have someone from the governor's office to lend a helping hand and, in certain instances, to help make a call, for instance, to the federal government to get things moving in a way that, frankly, a governor's office, a staff member can do, perhaps a bit differently than a local emergency manager. And so it was interesting to me to hear the governor of Washington staff talk about the importance in a disaster scenario of having a robust team across the state who could embed themselves with emergency managers and just help get things done for citizens of the affected counties in terms of managing the disaster. And so our goal here is to continue on the good work that's been done by the legislature, by past governors, and just find more opportunities to engage, certainly not to undermine the work that's already been done.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it may go to Representative Albright's question on the special revenue, the 2001 account. If you could explain where the receipts and the transfer incoming, I'm talking on the bottom of page 4 there. So when we look at balance in, it's pretty self-explanatory, but if you could explain exactly what is the receipts and what are the transfer ins from?
Mr. Schmitter.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I'll defer to Ms. Simpson. To the extent we can't answer in detail, we'll provide answers subsequently.
Ms. Simpson.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, Representative Vogel, thank you. The receipts are the transfers from the Met Council for their portion of the special revenue fund, and the transfers in are transfers from other state agencies.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. So basically, the transfer in are back charges to all of the agencies as well as the Met Council?
Ms. Simpson.
Chair Nelson, Representative Vogel, that is correct. That is the portion that the agencies pay to the governor's office for their portion of the special revenue fund.
Okay, and
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's okay.
And then the expenditures are what?
Ms. Simpson.
Chair Nelson, Representative Vogel, the special revenue fund is used to pay for our dues towards the National Governors Association, the Midwestern Governors Association, the National Lieutenant Governors Association, and the staffing costs at the governor's office.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as recently as 2016, it was $1,078 million, right? Now it's 80% higher, almost $900 million more. So, you know, what I'm looking at here is why would that have accelerated so quickly in really 3 years from 2016 at $1 billion, $78 million to now $1,945 million in the forecast or in the governor's request as well as the forecast.
Ms. Simpson, I don't know if that's the right decimal point, if that's the billion or is that a million?
It says thousands at the top of the page.
I'm sorry. It is a million. It's early.
I make the mistake myself when you're looking at these numbers and you start, okay, they're big numbers and
I'm sorry.
Put the decimal point in the wrong place.
It is.
Representative Vogel, it's an easy mistake to make.
But In any case, it's nearly doubled, and that was the question is, why has it nearly doubled in that short of time?
Ms. Simpson.
Chair Nelson, Representative Bogle. The special revenue fund was increased during the date the administration in response to increased staffing costs. The Walzen administration intends on keeping the special revenue fund at the same level.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I was asking the questions, and I apologize for the billion thing, it is difficult here. But, you know, we've almost doubled the charge that we're giving to the state agencies from the governor's office. So basically, as we go through the rest of this, I think it's important that we realize that although the agency budgets are asking for money, that there's almost a doubling in the amount of money that's being assessed to each one of those agencies by the governor's office. So what we really have here is, you know, a duplicate revenue duplicate expenditures. It's not unlike Minute to some extent, but I do think that it's something that we should investigate because all of these agencies, even the smaller agencies, are picking up bigger share of this as a chargeback to them. So if we have an agency that has a $200,000 or $300,000 budget, they're spending part of that to go to the governor's office, which to me from a financial standpoint impedes their work to give to another state agency, and it just it's confusing mess. I know there's not a question there, but I do think it's something that we should be paying attention to and maybe looking at whether or not that should be so high because we are impeding other agencies' work.
Representative Vogel, some of that is the way we've set up our through legislation, how these agencies are funded. Some of that's our fault. So if some of that stuff, if we want to change that, we have the opportunity to change that and simplify that stuff and maybe make direct appropriations that need to different agencies instead of having them charge for their services back from each other. But that's something that it's a long discussion we can have during the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree totally.
And I think Ms. Roberts at some point could give us some more detailed item by item. I mean, depending how far down we want to go in the budget, we could start counting paper clips also. So, I mean, it's a matter of how deep we want to go in the budget. I'm sure that we have those cost items, like this is going to be divided out more so. So, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schmitter, I want to reiterate something in recent past of outreach that worked fantastic because I was personally involved with it. It was a 35W bridge collapse. Governor Puente worked hard at working with my group, the EMS and the fire background, and made that actually a terrible situation really come to light. And that shows how a governor's outreach really did work well. So looking at this, I'm concerned that I'm with Representative Long on this. I think you're asking for the right amount of people because even I haven't talked to the governor personally, but listening to him from far, I see that in a speech he recently gave, he said, our job is to partner with business. Now, to have a Democratic governor say that is amazing. And I was excited when I heard that because that's what outreach is about, is getting in there to know people like Governor Puente knew the first responders. He knew us by name. He'd walk up to us, and it was all by name. And I think that's where we have to go because when we have problems like this or when we have to troubleshoot together, even with business or with communities, and if our governor's out there, that goes a long way, and it sounds like he, from everything I've heard in the speeches he's given, he's also said that he wants to include the legislators in this, whatever side we're on. And so I'm really concerned that if we do have to cut some of this, we're going to lose that momentum of where we're going and where we want to bring the state. And I think it's a great plan. And I also look very much forward to him being at the zoo soon with me. So I'm going to leave my questions there.
And members, we got two more presentations that we have. And so I'm trying to get this. I want to wrap this up by 9 o'clock. So if we can get shorter answers and shorter questions, would be great. I don't think there was a question there. It's more of a comment.
No, I guess I'm more concerned that the question would be is that if you do have to dig and you do have to cut, I just hope it's not to the outreach. I think that you're maybe going to – I would like to see you go deeper into the budget to cut and continue with the new plan of outreach. I think that's where we are in the space. By just sending letters and out, it just doesn't do. So I would like to recommendation, I guess, with the statement that if you do cut, you cut deeper into some place where, you know, that's my recommendation.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got I got a couple comments and a couple questions, and the one is with the new basically agency you're starting for outreach. It tells me that the agencies that are out there now aren't doing their job, because we have agencies on the ground, 100 agencies more or less in Minnesota, that go out and deal with the problems in the state. And if, as you say, during your groups, your meetings the governor had around the state, that they feel a disconnect with government, it's not from the legislators, because we talk to them all the time. It's from the governor's office and from the agencies that the governor is in charge of, that have, for lack of any other term, they rule with an iron hand, and the people have no voice. And these agencies are set up. Their commissioners are appointed by the governor. They have the ability to make rules outside of legislative process. They can fee and fine and just basically make life hell for people. And that's what you're going to hear in greater Minnesota. The other thing that I would like to ask is, you know, you said the governor made approximately 1,500 appointments. How many of those appointments are from greater Minnesota?
Chair,
Mr. Schmitter.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, Representative Green, appreciate the point, and I think that, again, my point and what the governor and lieutenant governor heard on the road, and they, like I say, back in the transition, and then again this week and quite a bit throughout the past 4 months, have been on the road all throughout the state. And I would just say respectfully, what they haven't heard, and what I don't mean to imply is sharp criticism of specific agencies, or sharp criticism of Governor Dayton, or sharp criticism of legislators in terms of a lack of interaction. But I guess I would just say it's not to undermine the work that's been done, but it's a desire for more. And I do think that I've heard this again and again from any number of different stakeholders, that there are a lot of either individuals or entities or associations that have positive relationships with agencies and enjoy interacting with agencies. Some, as you say, express frustration, and we'll continue to work on that. But I do think there's often a view that the governor's office is obviously the head of the executive branch, but it can be helpful sometimes simply to have a conversation directly with the governor's office. And so, as you can see, when I walk through some of the numbers, there are a lot of folks who want to be able to interact with agencies on specific issues, but then also want to interact with the governor's office directly, because you know, he serves as the governor for this entire state. And so I think, again, there are many folks who want to interact with both, or you know, multiply, you know, agencies, the governor's office, their legislators, and I think that's a good thing and a thing to be encouraged, and the governor and lieutenant governor want to prioritize that. As to your question about past appointments, I was referring to the sheer number of appointments that Governor Dayton did during his time in that appointments function. So I don't have at this point the statistics on how many of Governor Dayton's appointments were from Greater Minnesota, but happy to get additional information on Greater Minnesota appointments for you and report back to the committee.
Representative Green.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was talking about Governor Walz and his appointments, and where those appointments are from. So if I could get that, I mean, I do have a lot of it. I should have brought it today. And it looks pretty dismal for Greater Minnesota when I look at the appointments that have been put in. And so that leads me to my other question, is what exactly does One Minnesota mean to the governor's office?
Mr. Schmitter, and I guess if you can get that information as far as where the appointments come from, they can get it to the committee, we can get it to everybody.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to get more information about that. But my point was that the 1,500 number referred to Governor Dayton. Governor Walz has made a smaller number of appointments, and happy to get information for you on those appointments.
Representative Green. Representative Hewitt. Oh, Hurtas.
Hurtas.
I'm looking at the H. I'm going, wait a second. Yeah, I guess. Anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Mr. Schmitter and Ms. Simpson. Just some clarification, and I'm looking at this request here. It's showing 2.5 new full-time employees, and on the bottom of that same page, on page 6, it refers to 7 full-time staff members. I think if I'm reading that correctly, are you saying that this office really then will be 7 members, and that you're moving people from somewhere else within the governor's office to this new proposed office of engagement?
And Mr. Schmitter, I keep hearing new, but from reading this, it's something they already do, but it's just, are you just moving people around and that looking for 2 additional staff, I guess?
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, representative, yes, the goal is to have a full complement of 7 people in this office. It did exist under Governor Dayton. It existed under Governor Pawlenty, and the most recent staffing complement there was roughly 4.5 FTEs. So our goal is to expand that number by 2.5 FTEs.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a little bit of concern with the overall proposal as it is, and I'm a little bit troubled by what appears to be increasingly the abdication of the legislature towards what the respective roles are with regard to separation of powers. And with regard to your comment about people want more interaction with their government, that's not a request for the governor. If the governor, and if the trend has been that the governor is overwhelmed with all these requests and trying to accommodate them, I think that reinforces my point. The process, and maybe a lack of understanding in civics with our general public, is that legislating begins here with the Senate and with the legislature. And with regard to the governor's office and having engagement with that process, I had a chance to visit with Governor Walz directly the first week of this legislative session, and I told him that I was going to give him the same advice I gave his competitor, and that was engage with the legislature by taking a little bit of time rather than making all these appointments, and come over to this building or the Senate office building and stick your head in a few of the doors of the offices of the people that sent a representative to represent them. That is engagement. And it's not the governor's role to be legislating. Yes, it's a role to lead an agenda, but that engagement should be happening with legislative leaders. And so I'm concerned that this is growing into a publicly funded campaign committee. This is really what I see all this outreach is about. And the outreach in terms of rural Minnesotans or even urban Minnesotans is to contact their legislator. And if we allow this slide to continue to go on, then we're going to continue to see increasing executive orders and increasing growth in the administrative branch, which has become the 4th branch of government. Not intended to be that way, but we need to get back to the basics of what our constitutional powers are and engage the public in the manner in which it was designed to be constructed. So with that, Governor Walz's response to my comment, he thought it was a good idea, and he himself reminded me that 47% of Minnesotans didn't vote for him. And so that was encouraging to hear that. I take him at his face value that he intends to do things that truly will unite Minnesota from the divisiveness that maybe has occurred. But the previous administration, as far as I'm concerned, had an absolute failure in that area of engaging directly with the legislature, and basically didn't engage, in my opinion, until the last few weeks of the session, in each of the sessions as governor. So leveraging the clock to the end, leveraging time to the end of the clock just to move a political agenda is not a good way to govern, and I hope that this governor won't do that, and I look forward to seeing him visit my office. Thank you.
Representative Lippert, you're going to get the last question because we're going to we're also running the clock out here, it looks like.
Thank you, Mr. Lippert. Chair. I'll be quick. Thanks, Mr. Schmitter. Based on some previous comments, I was just curious of what this might look like at the federal level, as whether the executive branch leaves this sort of outreach to the legislative branch. And so I was just looking up quickly. I found that the president has an office of public liaison. Is that an office that's similar to Office of Public Engagement. Do you know what that Office of Public Liaison looks like? Like how significant the staffing is?
Mr. Schmitter.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, Representative Lippert, absolutely. I think that what you're seeing across the country, and I talked about this a bit with different governors, chiefs of staff of both parties last week when I was at the National Governors Association Conference in D.C., is you're seeing governors adopt a model that is very similar to the White House's model under President Trump and President Obama and past presidents, which includes three really key functions. One is the communications function that interacts with the media. Two is that legislative policy function that's interacting with the legislature or Congress. And three is that public engagement, public liaison function. And so I think Presidents Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump all had a significant public engagement, public liaison function meant to engage with individual constituents and then association groups, et cetera, across the country. And so this model that we have here on a much smaller scale, and I think similarly in governor's offices across the country, is based in part on how the White House does it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's helpful for me, and I would just simply say at this time when we need to be building trust in government in any way we can, I think efforts for outreach, wherever they come from, are very important. So thank you.
Representative Albright. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a 10-second comment. No response needful at this time, but in regards to the line of questioning and suggestion that Representative Vogel suggested about the Special Revenue Fund, I'm just wondering if at some later date we could have a conversation and have your response to moving the Special Revenue Fund to a general fund appropriation.
It's more of a comment. And if you could get us a breakdown of what is it, what the ins and outs are on that Special Revenue Fund and what's being paid for out of it, and we can go for that. And we can have a full discussion on it.
Thank you.
As you can see, we have lots of questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you all very much.
And while we're getting the next presentation set up, Representative Hewitt, did you get a chance to read the minutes?
I did, Mr. Chair, and I so far move.
Representative Hewitt moves that the minutes for the meeting of February 28th, 2019 be approved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion minutes are approved. And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape. And I see we have in our packets there is a handout. Yes, I'm trying to think of it. But anyway.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, guests, my name is Kent Whitworth. It's my privilege to serve as the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. With me today is David Kelleher, our Director of Public Policy, and I'm also pleased to introduce David Hakenson, the President of the Minnesota Historical Society and our Governing Board. Mr. Hakenson is in the audience with us. We thank you for the opportunity to have provided an overview several weeks ago, and so this morning we'll just very briefly touch on what we do to provide context for our budget and for the governor's recommendations. As I mentioned several weeks ago, our mission is simply this: to use the power of history to transform lives. Specifically, we do that by preserving, by sharing, and connecting. Lots of conversation in the previous testimony about the importance of connecting, and we take that seriously at the Minnesota Historical Society. We do operate a statewide network of historic sites and museums. We teach the public about history through exhibits and public programs. We use publications and programming for school children and lifelong learners. I think our remarks concluded with reference to National History Day and the success we had in 2018. I'm pleased to report that since we met with you last, our National History Day regional conferences are underway. They kicked off in Duluth and then in Bemidji, and so we are ready for another exciting year, and I hope that each of you are aware of those contests that are taking place in your districts. And if you want a shot of inspiration, I would encourage you, if you can and enjoy the entire National History Day contest, get to the award presentation. That is quite invigorating, and you will have great optimism for the future as you see those Minnesota students excel.
You also, in addition to seeing the network, we operate 26 sites. I had the privilege to be with our site managers, our programmers, and strategic communications folks last week on North Shore at Split Rock. But you see those 26 sites that represent all parts of Minnesota. And then I'd also like to touch on just the scale of our collections. There's a slide there that talks about, that quantifies the depth and breadth to these not only statewide significant collections, but nationally, and I would argue internationally significant collections. So that provides a little bit of a backdrop, some context for our budget and the governor's recommendations. That at-a-glance slide gives you the statistics that, again, reinforce the comprehensive nature of our mission and our work. So I'll hand off to Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, for the record, I'm
Mr. Kelleher.
David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. And as Kent said, we will take a very quick pass through the overall context of our budget to give you a sense of the scale and scope of what we do. This slide shows you the overall budget of the Minnesota Historical Society, and a significant component of that is the state's general fund appropriation made each biennium, approximately $23 million, and makes up roughly 32% of our overall operating budget. A significant part as well is in the pie chart here shown in green, about 44% that is other non-state revenue. That is comprised of admissions revenue, sales at the stores, contributions from individuals and members. And we do have 25,000 members of the Minnesota Historical Society statewide and beyond, making us one of the largest state historical societies in terms of membership in the country. And they are an important part of our audience as well as our financial base in doing our work. Mr. Chair, members, how we spend the money is shown in this slide. The work is done by 458 full-time equivalents. These individuals, hardworking, talented staff, are at the History Center and at historic sites across the state. Some of these individuals are seasonal and or part-time, so that's the scope of the employee base that we have. Mr. Chair, moving to the governor's recommendations, the governor recommended two new initiatives, two change items for us in this budget recommendation. The first one is the operating adjustment that supports employees' salaries, health care costs, and pension increase. Our employees participate in state employee benefits, including health care and retirement programs, and the increases that were put into place in the retirement programs last year need to be funded because we were not included in the pool that supported those increases. So those three elements make up this change item for operating support. This would allow us to continue our current operations at their current levels. And with that, Mr. Chair, Kent is going to take the second change item.
So the second recommendation from the governor's budget is our Museum Professionals and Development Program. At the previous testimony, I mentioned that inclusion and diversity is one of the strategic priorities of the Minnesota Historical Society. An important part of our job at MNHS is to make sure that all Minnesotans are involved and included in everything that we do. This includes programming, this includes interpretation, this also includes the composition of our board, and certainly the composition of our staff. In that last area, this very talented pool of staff members at MNHS, we have made some strides in the area of inclusion and diversity, but we've got work to do. One of the things we've done in recent years is to develop several museum fellows programs to help college-age students, particularly of color, learn more about history and museum fields. This has not only been funded by general fund dollars, but also by private sector funding from foundations and individuals. This program that is included in the governor's budget takes our efforts to diversify our staff to the next level. And we are very interested in, we are building somewhat of a pipeline. We've had a chance to talk to Chairman Nelson about this. And this program gives us an opportunity to as we work these undergrad and graduate students through these fellows programs to identify a couple of these professionals and bring them into a three-year, more immersive experience. It would be a rotation that exposes them to all facets of our work. And so we're very excited about the impact, the long-term impact that this Museum Professionals Development Program could have. So I think that that concludes our prepared comments about the recommendations. We would be happy to field any questions, and we certainly appreciate the governor's support of our operating budget.
Members, I got 5 minutes for questions. If anyone's got questions, Representative Green.
I just have one. You're looking for up to what it would be, $375,000. Develop a program to recruit and retain young professionals in the history and museum field. How many people are you looking to recruit, and how many jobs are available there?
This particular program would add two FTEs to the MNHS staff. It would also include 0.5 to administer the program. As I said, this is the continuum in a pipeline that has been developed that starts with introduction of this field to undergraduates, and then there's there are several graduate museum fellow program opportunities, but this would add two full-time positions, and it would be a three-year commitment rotating through every facet of the organization.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry for laughing, but I asked how many jobs are open in this field that you're going to be trying to train professionals in, and basically you're telling me the 2.5 that you're creating?
Oh, well.
Mr. Whitworth, yeah, I guess.
Mr. Chair.
You know, I misunderstood it too, but yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Green, frankly, there is huge opportunity across the public history field for candidates of color. There's not an organization in the country that's not looking to address this issue. And frankly, the Minnesota Historical Society has been viewed as one of the leaders, if not the leader, in this field in terms of engaging underserved audiences and introducing them to history and museum field. I will be glad to provide some research. The American Alliance of Museums has done a great deal of research on this, and so I can provide numbers. But this is a huge opportunity for emerging professionals of color, not only in the state of Minnesota and at MNHS, but across the field. So I'll be happy to provide detailed information.
Any further questions? Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, and to the director, one of the things, and you brought it up real quick, of people of color, and our story is changing here in Minnesota rapidly. And I do appreciate the next to the 1968 exhibit, the Smullyan exhibit that you had. And I look forward to the Historical Society doing more on that level to tell the story of Minnesota in our evolving culture that we have. So thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, thank you. I'm glad you've had a chance to experience that exhibition, and I'm pleased to let you know that in December we will open up a new Native American gallery at the History Center, and this is a long-term commitment to devote that space at the History Center to the story of the indigenous people of Minnesota. So we'll make sure you're well aware of that opening. I think it opens December 7th.
And Mr. Whitworth, I bet you there's, like every other field out there, the aging of our population, the baby boomers moving into retirement, I'm sure there's going to be openings across the field for people of those type of professionals, and I'm sure that those are job opportunities out there across the country.
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right, and one of the things that excites me about being at the Minnesota Historical Society is seeing that next generation of talent at MNHS, and as we interact with local history organizations, we see that as well. There are seasoned veterans like myself that have got 30 years in this, but we are so invigorated by the next generations coming up that are just as passionate about this work, and they're focused very much on the relevance of history as we shape a brighter future together.
Thank you, sir. Any further questions? If not, thank you. And if you have any more, or when the governor sends his revised budget to us, we'll hopefully have an idea where we're going to be able to spend our money.
Thank you so much, Chairman Nelson.
Thank you.
The next in the committee is, the next before us is the Public Disclosure Board. And members, just so you know, while he's coming down here, the books are full now. The last time we had it, we just had the one section in there. If you want to take the book with you so you can study it, want the paper in your hand, feel free to take it. Just make sure you bring it back when we have budget discussions, because this is what we're going to be working out of. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As I've already appeared before you to explain the role of the agency, and because the majority of you are, in fact, all of you, are part of our regulated client base, I'm just going to go directly to the two change items that we have, which we're happy to say that the governor has included in his budget request. The first is an increase in the base budgeting, or a base operating budget of the agency. Clearly, our yearly budget is $1,048,000, which supports the board's operation and a staff of 9 FTE. We're requesting an increase of $75,000 per fiscal year, which is about a 7.25% increase to $1,123,000 per fiscal year. The last time the board asked for an increase to the base was in the FY 2014-2015 biennium. At that point, the base was increased to $1 million. We have had, as all small agencies had, minor increases from Governor Dayton to help reflect the increases in salary and other benefits, so that the current current operating budget is again $1,048,000 for 9 FTE. As you see from the first page of our change item request, though, the amount of the budget that is used, of that $1,048,000, that's used for just staff salary and benefits, has increased from 64% in FY 2014 to a current 85% in FY 19, and based on projections provided to us by MMB, in FY 20 that would be 89%, and in FY 21 that would be 91%. The entire budget would be spent on, again, staff and benefits. If you add the two largest fixed costs, which is our lease and the fixed minute costs, then in FY 21 you're looking at 97% of the budget being for those, again, for staff costs, lease, and IT costs, with only 3% of the budget left for things like outreach to Greater Minnesota for treasurer training, for developing our website, for providing the sort of disclosure that we try to provide to the public once election results or economic interest statements or lobbying reports come in. That, from the board's perspective, that's certainly not a tenable position. If the $75,000 increase is not part of the final budget, then we would have to at least eliminate one position at a minimum.
So, Mr. Sigurdsson, the one up here on the FTEs, that's not an additional staff. That's, if we don't get this, you're going to have to cut a position to make your ends meet.
Correct, Mr. Chair. There is no increase to the complement for the board from the $75,000 increase. It's just maintaining the existing FTE of 9. That would be 11% cut, basically. I realize that it's only one individual, but for us, that would be an 11% cut in our staff. That would immediately impact our ability to, frankly, pick up the phone. In our agency, we believe one of the more important functions that we provide is the basically pick up the phone, answer the email, help the volunteer treasurer figure out the somewhat complicated obligations of Chapter 10A that they really weren't aware of when they signed up to be your volunteer treasurer, and to try to avoid violations by explaining them some fairly complicated obligations that are in Chapter 10A. And again, it's not just the campaign finance program, it's also the lobbying program and the economic interest disclosure for over 2,000 public and local officials. So that's the basis of our request for the operating budget increase. Mr. Chairman, should I go on directly to the second increase or change item that we've requested is a one-time $50,000 appropriation to support the board's movement of the campaign finance reporter software. That's the free software that we provide to all treasurers. It helps them file reports, obviously. It's an electronic program that loads, it's PC-based. You load it onto your PC. At the appropriate point, you can file a report with us electronically, which we then can instantly upload into our database, no data entry required. It also provides online or I should say real-time review of the expenditures and contributions that are being entered into the software, so it helps the treasurer spot violations. You may recall that in Chapter 10A there is about a 90-day period when you can return a problematic or a contribution that would put you over some limit and clear a violation. So we think that we help, through that software, campaigns comply with the statute. Well, the problem is that it's old. It was originally written in 1998. It is PC-based, so it doesn't work on an Apple PC, and we've now found out that it doesn't work on a Chrome PC either. Additionally, we're very concerned that at some point there will be a version of Windows that it won't operate on as well. So our hope is that during this year, a non-election year, staff, our IT staff is already well into the process of redeveloping the application so it's web-based, so that we're no longer going to be reliant on someone's operating system for their computer. There are some opportunities here to take some of that load off of staff and make sure that we get at least the great majority of the work done in 2019. So we're looking for this appropriation to be able to go out to outside vendors and make sure that we have a security review so that all the data is, in fact, we believe that we have a plan in place that will keep all the data that you submit onto the system secure, but we want to have that reviewed so that we can verify that conclusion. We want to do some load testing to make sure that our online system doesn't get bogged down if we have 150 treasurers or whatever the number may be online at the same time. And there is the majority of the programming is being done in a very modular way, so there may be an opportunity to again sort of compress the calendar and have some features of the software, for example, report generation, be done by outside vendors to support the work that's being done, again, for the most part, by our staff. So, Mr. Chairman, that's a quick review of our two change items.
Representative Elkins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Looking wrong.
First of all, Mr. Sigurdsson, I'd like to think that I'm speaking on behalf of everyone sitting around this table, that that we're all very grateful for the work that your team does. I think we all feel that we've been very well served. The campaign finance laws are complicated, and we appreciate the hand-holding that that your staff provides our treasurers in order to comply with the law. So that being said, the next thing I want to say is that I'm first of all very supportive of your initiative to update the campaign finance reporter software. I think I agree with you that this work is way overdue. A couple of questions. One is, where does the data for the campaign finance reporter, physically reside? Do you have a server of your own in the Centennial Building? Where does it physically reside right now?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Chair Nelson, Representative, the current application, the data is stored on your PC until you transmit the report, which is basically an abbreviated access database, a very small access database, which is sent up to us, and then the servers, the primary production servers are within the Centennial Office Building, although we do have mirrored site servers that are off-site at another location that are, full-time mirroring any data so that if, worst-case scenario, if we lost those servers, we would have an immediate backup.
Okay, so follow-up to that, Mr. Chair. Are there plans with the new version of the application for the data to be secured within a state server?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Chairman, Representative, yes, the plan for the new application is it's going to be in Microsoft SQL Server application, and that all data will be encrypted and available only to the treasurer slash committee that has access to that particular application. In other words, staff will not have the ability to look at the data that's being stored on our servers through the online application until you generate, again, a report, just like it would be with your PC. At the point in which a report is generated, there's a transfer basically from the database into our operational site, and we get to see the information contained in that report. But otherwise, it's encrypted and not available even to board staff to look at.
That's very good. Mr. Chair, where will the SQL Server be physically located? In the Centennial Building?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. Again, the primary production server is in the Centennial Office Building, but the backup mirroring server at an off-site location.
So, yeah, I just want to say that, I've been immersing myself in all things MNIT for about the last month. And as we, heard the introductory, presentations from each of the departments, you observed me asking questions about their IT. And I just have to say that of all of the overview presentations we've heard, this one actually concerns me more than any of the others. The notion that we have two people in a department without architectural or project management oversight rewriting on their own on hardware that's located outside of a state data center are going to rewrite an application of this importance by themselves and continue to store the data on a server outside of a state data farm is very, very concerning to me.
Noted. Representative Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, perhaps we should have an offline conversation about that to see how we can address your concerns. I would say that the current staff, frankly, are the individuals who wrote Campaign Finance Reporter, or at least have been maintaining it since 1998, including several rewrites that were necessary because of statute changes. But I understand your point. The Campaign Finance Board was not part of the minute consolidation. We are outside of that because of our relationship with the executive branch. But there may be an opportunity here to look at least having a peer review through a minute to make sure there may be a conversation here that we can have to try to address your concerns.
Just follow up on MSB.
Quickly, because we have a couple other questions and we're running short of time.
One of my main concerns with that would be that if you have two people who have been maintaining this family of applications since 1998, in my experience in development environments like that, they're probably not documenting their work in a way that if they were hit by a bus one day, somebody else could pick it up and carry it on. If I'm wrong about that, I'd like to be shown that I'm wrong, but I would very doubt that the documentation that's being produced by a two-member team writing something this complicated would be adequate for somebody to pick up their work if something were to happen to them, like a retirement, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm done, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Elkins, if you have any, if you offered to let you have a conversation offline and share those with them, probably more better one-on-one. And Representative Albright.
I'll be quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've seen and I've observed that there are a number of bills concerning the Campaign Finance Board going through the Elections Subcommittee. And I'm just wondering, in light of the presumption that some of those will pass into law, how your department and your board's responsibilities will be able to handle any of those with the change items that you have presented here this morning.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Chairman Nelson, Representative, it would, of course, depend on which particular piece of legislation we're talking about. Some of the legislation which we've worked with, for example, there's one dealing with Hennepin County moving some of their reporting obligations under Chapter 383B over the Campaign Finance Board. We've had discussions with Hennepin County and the volume of committees that they're talking about, we believe we can handle without a fiscal note. In other words, with we can absorb those costs. There are other bills which, frankly, I'm still evaluating, dealing with providing additional funds in certain situations of a level of independent expenditures occur, and some other variations on that theme, which, frankly, I'm still evaluating. But I'll we're certainly working on those areas.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, it certainly sounds like Mr. Representative Freiberg has been a busy representative, supportive of your committee. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Albright, it's Representative Dean has the Elections Committee, and Representative Freiberg has Government Operations, which is busy, which is always busy. Representative Freiberg, seeing as how you've been named.
Yeah, a couple of my bills were referenced, so I think that was why I was mentioned.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson and members. Our next meeting is Thursday. If you bring your books in, you ought to take them home with you or to your office with you and read them through if you're having trouble sleeping at night. But bring them back Thursday with you, and members, with that, I think we're adjourned.